I'm Christopher Lydon with James Kaplan and his fresh take on the life of Frank Sinatra, the iconic, maybe the greatest performing artist of the American century, with more and more emphasis on the word artist. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is about the singer who instructed us, for better and worse, in love, who infiltrated the dream life of millions, a ring-a-ding-ding swinger and a wee small hours depressive, who had spectacular falls and returns to glory through 7 decades of stardom, and who is, as he said he would be, still around.
Night and day, you are the one.
James Kaplan, thank you for Frank, the voice. You extend a long season of fine musical biographies, Thelonious Monk, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, among others. How is it that every few years we need a new take on Francis Albert Sinatra?
Because he just doesn't go away, Chris.
James Kaplan, where do the new stories come from? And you've got hundreds of them in this book. And then give us your take on this incredibly complicated guy.
Well, it was a daunting prospect to embark on a new biography of a man who is perhaps the most chronicled human being in recent history, certainly. A few years back, I did a New Yorker profile on Jerry Lewis, and that led to my doing a book with Jerry called Dean and Me, his memoir of his time with Dean Martin. And as we were finishing the book, he invited me to the 2004 Labor Day Telethon, which was in Los Angeles that year. And one night I went out to dinner with a bunch of musicians who were working on the show. And it was an Italian restaurant in Santa Monica, and there was a lot of food and a lot of booze, and I was just there as a guy, not a journalist, and everybody got very happy, and the musicians got to talking. It turned out each and every one of them had worked with Sinatra. And so I figured, musicians being musicians and the plain-spoken folk that they are, that pretty soon I would be hearing the mafia stories and the fistfight and the women's stories. But instead, every one of these guys spoke in tones of absolute awe about what a fill in your expletive there, genius this guy was musically. I was really taken by surprise by this, not by the fact that he was a genius, we know this, but just to hear these guys talking with completely unbuttoned, with their hair down, and talking about him this way. I was about to begin my next book, and I thought, well, you know, so much has been written about Sinatra, but so much about the gossip and the fistfights and the mob and the women. To a great degree, the genius has never made it onto the page. And I also thought, what about writing a book of empathy about Frank Sinatra, trying to make the reader feel as though the reader could know what it was like to be that person?
We'll never get to the bottom of all the mafia stories. You know, was he hanging with Lucky Luciano in Havana? Did he deliver money to...
Yes. yes, to both.
To Meyer Lansky. To me, the great insight in your book, the first one, is that his mother was the mafia. That was his introduction to rough, tough people and language and emotion. Somebody said when he looked out, often fearfully, into a huge crowd of listeners, what he saw in every face was his mother. That was what scared him.
Well, I was very fortunate to know Mario Puzo a little bit. And I did an extended interview with him once where we talked about all kinds of subjects. And one in particular that came up was his own mother. You know, very tough depression childhood. Father was institutionalized. Mother had something like 8 children and had to support all of them. And she was a pistol. And Puzo told me that his mother was the model for Don Corleone. Well, he was very serious about it. He wasn't joking around. When I began to research Sinatra, I very quickly saw that Dolly Sinatra, less than 5 feet tall, volcanic temper, volcanic ambition, constantly striving to lift her little family. Frank was an only child, by its bootstraps out of what was called, and forgive me, but this is what they called called it back then, Guinea Town in Hoboken, New Jersey, is the Italian section of Hoboken, into what Dolly thought of as a better neighborhood, constantly striving. She was a political person, kind of a political genius, really. She spoke every dialect of Italian so she could walk around those Italian neighborhoods and talk to everybody. Mm-hmm. She was a Democratic ward boss, a suffragist, and as Sinatra later said, she scared the you-know-what out of him. He right. told Shirley MacLaine that he never knew whether his mother was going to hug him or hit him.
She was a midwife and an abortionist. I think that's established. This was a grandma who referred to Frank's children. She would call him, hey, fuckface. You know, this was tough stuff from the beginning. But you're right. It's the music we got to keep coming back to. It's the music that gives us goosebumps. I'd love to listen to Sweet Lorraine from the 40s. It says so many different things, but let's listen.
Just found joy. I'm as happy as a baby boy when he's playing with a choo-choo toy. When I'm with my sweet Lorraine, she's got a pair of eyes that are bluer than the summer skies. When you see them, you're gonna realize why I love my sweet Lorraine.
That was Nat King Cole at the piano.
You can hear his, yeah. I mean, you listen, you know that it's Nat King Cole, and you think, yeah, sure. And Buddy Rich on the drums, and Paul Desmond comes in. Coleman Hawkins was there, too. Unbelievable. It was the Metronome All-Stars. It was a one-off. Frank didn't usually sing with great jazz musicians, although he and they had enormous respect for each other. And you can hear it on that song. I mean, he is just swinging. He's very loose. He's very happy. You can hear the smile in his voice.
Two things strike me. One, the aspiring jazz singer early on, and second, the absolute affinity and sympathy and admiration, thoroughly mutual, with African-American players of the first rank.
Yes. Sinatra haunted 52nd Street as a young man. And he heard Billie Holiday, who was, by the way, she was almost the exact same age he was, just a few months older than Frank. But her career blossomed very quickly. You know, she was discovered by John Hammond when she was barely out of her teens and went straight to Benny Goodman. And she was making it on 52nd Street. And she was a complete revelation to Sinatra. Just the way that she could put sex into a song, the way she could make it a conversation and really speak directly to the listener. He idolized Lester Young. He idolized Louis Armstrong. He heard all these cats on 52nd Street. And his feeling for black people and black musicians was deep and it was genuine. Don't forget, he was an Italian-American in a time when Italian-Americans were not legally considered white. So there was a certain amount of course, there's always been racism between these various ethnic groups and certainly between Italian-Americans and black people. But Sinatra just never had it. He never got inoculated with that germ.
Can I say, I saw him one night listening like an altar boy in the St. Regis Hotel. It wasn't Billie Holiday, alas, but Mabel Mercer.
Oh, boy.
Whom he admired hugely. He studied her phrasing, and he was there very humbly in the audience as if he were at school. I have a tailor, if I can insert this, who made Miles Davis's clothes, and he said to Miles one time in the tailor shop, "Do you really like Frank Sinatra?" And Miles said, "If he had one tit, I'd marry him." And I believe it.
Yes.
Those men did not give up that sort of respect lightly.
No. And Miles, whom I knew a tiny bit, certainly to almost nobody.
Yeah, exactly. Let's listen to another bit of classic Sinatra. Again, there's a African-American connection here, but the song Don't Worry About Me.
Don't worry about me. I'll get along. Forget about me. Be happy, my love.
That melancholic, almost depressive Sinatra, Mm. I slowed that song way, way down. I heard him sing it live. What do you hear there?
You know, I think that the melancholy in Sinatra's singing is not a sometime thing. I think it is, I think that it's a constant in his art. And I think it's a lot of the reason that he's so appreciated by black musicians and indeed a lot of black people in general. In a certain way, it's almost an operatic version of the blues. He was a tortured man. He was an incredibly complicated man, impatient, obsessive compulsive, diagnostically, volcanic temper like his mother. Having a mother like that, I think, put him in a perpetual state of unease the rest of his life. Even as so much seemed to come easily to him, nothing felt easy to him. And I think you hear that in the music. One song I like to mention sometimes is The Best Is Yet to Come, which he does so beautifully with Basie. Tony Bennett does such a fantastic version of that song, and it's such a different thing than Sinatra's. When Sinatra's singing The Best Is Yet to Come, you almost listen to it skeptically. Is the best really yet to come? I'm not sure. When Frank's singing it, Bennett sings it with absolute sunny joy. It's a beautiful rendition, but a totally different thing.
Can we talk about Ava Gardner, who fills a huge piece of your book?
Oh, yeah.
Talk about melancholy. Talk about obsession. An appeal to the obsessive in all of us.
Yes.
What was that all about, James?
I have her. She's still looking at me from above my desk.
Oh, my Lord.
that curl of hair over one eye and looking, she looks hungover, a little blousy, very wicked. She looks as if she's having a very nasty thought at that moment. She was never shy about expressing her nasty thoughts in the saltiest possible language. She and Sinatra are very similar. They were peas in a pod in a lot of ways. They were both depressives. They were both sexual fanatics. They loved sex. They loved alcohol. They hated sleep. They were promiscuous and unapologetic. They were unapologetic in general. And so I call them in the book an unstable chemical compound that was fated not to bond. They were never going to be the pair that wound up behind a white picket fence. But they really just, to change the metaphor, they really pushed each other's buttons in every good and every bad conceivable way. Furniture smashing fights and astonishing makeup sex. Mm. That was their cycle.
Mm. Could we play that "I'm a Fool to Want You," which was his sort of musical obituary of the affair, although it never ended.
Never ended.
I'm a fool to want you. I'm a fool to want you. To want a love that can't be true. A love that's there for others too. I'm a fool to hold you.
You know, he did that song in one take. And he not only did that song in one take, which was unusual for him. That was very usual. That was what he did in the movies. He was one take Charlie in Hollywood. But when it came to his records, he did as many as 22 takes sometimes. This one he did in one. He altered the lyric in a way that has never been explained. The writer of that lyric, Joel Herron, I believe is still with us in his 90s. Joel Herron has never let the cat out of the bag about what exactly Sinatra changed in that one take, but it so struck Joel Herron that they included Sinatra in the credits. They gave him a writer credit on the song. He did that one take and ran out of the studio in tears. That was it. That was the end of the affair.
And it informed, though, forever so much of his, not just his life, but his singing. He and Ava Gardner married in 1951, divorced in, 53?
Yep.
Then the endless series of songs that came out of it, the Wee Small Hours in the Morning, but just listen to One for My Baby.
That, of course, is the great Bill Miller on the piano, whom I was very fortunate to be able to catch and interview before he left us.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story you ought to know. We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode. Make it one for my baby and one more for the road.
Is that the definitive song? As he said, he never liked to do a concert without singing that song.
Well, it's Harold Arlen, Johnny Mercer. You just don't get any better than that. The two great geniuses, and it is a genius song. It is a genius arrangement, and Bill Miller was so responsible for that. The pairing of the two of them, the setting of that, and yes, Nelson Riddle was the one who said Ava Gardner taught Frank Sinatra how to sing a torch song. And until the end of his life, she was really his muse in that regard. No matter how many women he was with, no matter who he was with, she was always with him.
You say it so well. There were others, and I'd like to just sample them. They're all great, but could we listen for a moment to Here's That Rainy Day?
Maybe I should have saved those leftover dreams. Funny, but here's that rainy day. Here's that rainy day they told me about, and I laughed at the thought that it might turn out this way.
James, you put it brilliantly. I mean, Ava Gardner is the muse of his life from then on.
I just want to point out, though, that on that song, what you have is this astonishing conjunction of four unparalleled geniuses. You not only have Sinatra singing that beautiful, beautiful song, you have Jimmy Van Heusen, who wrote that astonishing melody. Van Heusen used to claim that he invented that melody when he was 14 years old. And it took him many years to find Johnny Burke, the other genius who set that who put the lyrics to that great song, and then Nelson Riddle, who arranged those strings in such a way that if you just listen to the strings, you begin to get goose flesh.
Major point about Sinatra right there: the man had incredible taste in associates. He was rather ruthless about letting them go when he thought he'd got the best of them. But he became the definition of talent and class. Everybody in the world wanted to be in that Sinatra band.
Yeah, and I would differ with you just slightly about that, Chris. You know, it was very much Nelson Riddle's take that Sinatra had finished with Nelson Riddle when Sinatra decided to start working with Billy May and some other terrific arrangers. In fact, Sinatra was always, his entire life was about looking for hits, and his entire life was about finding fresh material. And it wasn't remotely that Sinatra felt he had used up Nelson Riddle or disdained him or anything like that. It was simply that he wanted a new sound. Nelson Riddle, who was is very similar to Sinatra in a lot of ways, from New Jersey, alcoholic, depressive, women obsessed. You can hear it in those strings for Here's That Rainy Day. You can absolutely hear that. Was mortally offended when Sinatra went looking for another arranger, but Sinatra came back to Nelson Riddle.
I was thinking simply, though, that Sinatra set a standard. For one thing, as Will Friedwald had said in that marvelous book on The Song Is You, that he set a standard of art in a rampantly commercial American popular genre. And people like Dave McKenna, people like Count Basie, so many people have said Sinatra sang the best songs. But then he also surrounded himself with the best players. Sweets Edison, just for those muted trumpet lines in the Nelson Riddle arrangements, for example.
Yes. Yes. He, as his valet George Jacobs said, Sinatra craved class like a junkie craves the needle. And he knew it when he saw it.
Yeah.
When he heard it, too.
Yeah. Let's listen to a not-so-melancholy Sinatra with Red Norvo in Australia. He sings sort of his own version of The Road to Mandalay.
Mm.
And I like it partly because you can hear a kind of happy guy, not the wild and crazy ring-a-ding-ding swinger, but a man who loved being on stage. He said, nobody can bug me out there. It's just me and the band. Mm. And obviously, he had a ton of fun. This is from the Kipling poem of a sort, On the Road to Mandalay. It's about a British soldier back in London missing his girlfriend in the East.
This particular song was written from the poem by Rudyard Kipling. Now, it seems that we have done a rather different version of Road to Mandalay so that his family has objected. And in anywhere in the British Empire, it's not to be played on the record. So they took it off the long-playing record of Come Fly With Me, and they replaced it with Chicago. That's how you happen to hear Chicago. And I made that one day when I was drinking or something, so I don't know the words now, so it's, forget it. But this is an unusual version of Road to Mandalay. It's comedic, but it swings, it jumps. And I think that Rudyard Kipling's sister was chicken, not to let us put it on the record.
By the old moon main pagoda, looking eastward to the sea, there's a Burma broad a-sittin', and I know she's got a yen for me. The wind is in those palm trees, and the temple bells, they say, come you back, you British soldier, come you back to Mandalay. Come you back to Mandalay. Come you back to Mandalay.
You can hear the smile in his voice, can't you?
The banter, a kind of interactive connection with that audience, for sure.
Yeah, and but also with the band. I mean, he just knew those guys were cooking behind him, and that's really that great crowd in front of him that was all for him, the great band in back of him. He was in bliss.
There's one other song, sort of high Sinatra. So many people think this is the best he ever did. Nice and Easy with Nelson Riddle. What, late 50s, early 60s?
Yeah.
Let's take it nice and easy. It's gonna be so easy for us to fall in love. Hey, baby, what's your hurry? Relax and don't you worry. We're gonna fall in love. We're on the road to romance, that's safe to say. But let's make all the stops along the way.
Is that one of your favorites?
I love it. I love it. I love the it's an incredibly sexy song, and nobody could write sex like Nelson Riddle. And Nelson Riddle had theories about he spoke about delaying the climax in his arrangements, made it very powerful. And Sinatra, nobody could arrange sex like Nelson Riddle, and nobody could sing it like Sinatra. It is just a mind-blowingly sexy song.
I think I always liked it, but then I like it more after reading Ben Ratliff of the New York Times talking with Bebo Valdez, the Cuban pianist, and that was one of the tunes that Bebo wanted to play in a conversation about music with Ben Ratliff. And what he said was, nobody can play music like this except in America. That kind of swing, that time, it's impeccable. Mm. The most difficult thing in the world, says Bebo Valdez, is to play slowly and keep time. When I listen to this, Sinatra singing Nice and Easy, I see American black people dancing.
That's fascinating because, you know, Sinatra was often taken to task, often by white jazz purists, I should add, for something that they used to call businessman's bounce. That's what they, that's how they referred to Sinatra's rhythm. And I really think that this song and so many others give the lie to that.
As long as I can remember, people have said Sinatra phrases the most.
Mm.
Do we know quite yet all of that means?
Well, he said there was a recent piece in the L.A. Times about the book we have in front of us, and the reviewer had known Mel Torme, and I think they had the same barber, and said something about Sinatra's phrasing to Mel Torme, and Torme quickly corrected this man, said, you know, with Frank, before the phrasing came the diction. The diction came first. Phrasing is a little bit of an amorphous word. I could hold forth on it if you'd like.
But please,
diction,
please.
Yeah. Phrasing, it's like bel canto. It's one of those expressions that mean different things to different people, and I think so much of what we refer to as Frank Sinatra's phrasing had to do with a few things. One was his insistence on perfect diction. He reviled singers who rolled over consonants.
Mm.
He also reviled singers who took a breath right in the middle of a phrase. All the things you are, somewhere between things and you are, there would be this big almost hiccup of a breath taken.
Mm.
He hated that. He learned at the back of the great Tommy Dorsey, who the superlative trombonist and band leader who could play a 32-bar legato. Sinatra learned breath control from Dorsey. And so he felt it was very important to carry the breath through, to have perfect diction. And then he studied the lyric of a song. He revered great lyricists and was so fortunate to work with so many brilliant lyricists.
Mm.
And he studied the lyric before he ever sang a note. He studied it as if it were a poem. He lived inside that lyric before he sang it.
Sometimes I think the thing I love most about Frank Sinatra, speaking of diction, is the way he would say, I took a trip on a train, not a trip on a train. And he would say, dreams come true.
That's Hoboken. That's Hoboken.
But it's beautiful.
It is beautiful. You know, the Persians used to say about their rugs, that it was a sin against Allah to make the rugs perfect. There had to be one tiny flaw in those gorgeous Persian rugs. That is Frank's dentalized Hoboken D's and T's.
But I love it. Can I just say, I met him the night of his last public performance, Labor Day weekend, 1994. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I went over to him. He'd been drinking a good deal of Jack Daniels, but looked like $1 trillion. I just stuck my hand out, hoping not to get shot. I said, Mr. Chairman, I simply wanted to say thank you. And he looked up, those beautiful violet eyes, and he said, anybody hit you, let me know. And it wasn't anybody hits you. It was anybody hits you, let me know. Later, I find out that he said that to Sammy Davis Jr. after they worked at one of his low points. Sammy Davis Jr. was opening for him at the Paramount in the early 50s.
Mm.
And Sammy wrote it in his book that Sinatra said, as they said goodbye, anybody hits you, let me know. But the pronunciation, the diction was half of it.
Oh, lucky you. What a gift.
Never washed my hand after that either. Could we talk about the movie Sinatra, mainly because it's a huge piece of the comeback that builds toward the climax of your book?
Yes. Yes, the non-existent horse's head. Yes, the two great myths about Sinatra and The Godfather were that Sinatra was, in fact, Johnny Fontaine, and that Tommy Dorsey was, in fact, Les Halley, and Willie Moretti was, in fact, Don Corleone. None of the above are true, of course. Godfather is a terrific book and a great pair of movies. And Sinatra, from the moment he picked up, and I read From Here to Eternity as part of my research for this book. It is a terrific novel. Book came out in February in 1951. Sinatra found it almost immediately. He was a passionate reader all his life.
Mm.
And he found in it this character, a little Italian-American from Brooklyn named Angelo Maggio, who was one of life's born downtrodden, had a chip on his shoulder. spoke straight out of the hood, Brooklyn, Bensonhurst, and Sinatra knew at the moment he read that that character that he was born to play Maggio in the movie that Harry Cohn of Columbia Studios had optioned almost immediately after that book came out. Sinatra began barraging Harry Cohn and the producer and the director-to-be of the movie with telegrams, dozens upon dozens of telegrams, every one of them signed Maggio. Harry Cohn was not persuaded at first. Harry Cohn saw Sinatra as – Sinatra had had a contract with MGM and he had done several pictures. It seemed that Sinatra could never get out of a sailor suit, you know. He was dancing around these MGM pictures trying to keep up with Gene Kelly, always in a sailor suit. And that's how Harry Cohn thought of Sinatra. He said, you're a singer. You're a hoofer. You can't play a dramatic role. Ava Gardner went to Harry Cohn, unbeknownst to Sinatra. And this was at a moment, by the way, when 3 years after Frank Sinatra had left his wife and children for Ava Gardner, Ava Gardner was getting tired of Frank Sinatra. His career was in the toilet. Her career was shooting like a shooting star, and she was supporting the both of them. He was broke. The IRS was after him. He had been dropped by MGM, by his agents, by Columbia Records. But nevertheless, it's the mark of true love. She went to Harry Cohn, head of Columbia Pictures, who was the biggest lech in the world, by the way, and said, "I will give you a free picture if you give Frank a screen test for From Here to Eternity." And Harry Cohn looked her up and down, this astonishing woman with a beauty that comes along once in every 100 years. And he thought, well, what else can I get for free? And he gave Sinatra the screen test, and Sinatra nailed it.
And then there's The Manchurian Candidate.
Yes.
In which he generated that movie and then later withdrew it after John F. Kennedy was assassinated. It was just too close for comfort.
Too close.
And yet, who can forget Sinatra in a judo fight, but also with Lawrence Harvey, with Janet Leigh flirting on a train, one of the great acting performances and certainly one of the great political movies ever made.
I can tell you a little tiny story about an on-set story about The Manchurian Candidate.
Please.
Lawrence Harvey. Sinatra comes in one day, and despite the fact that he wound up performing a great role and it was a terrific movie, movies, as you know, are when they're being shot are like watching paint dry, and Sinatra was very impatient with the process and walked onto the set one day in a foul mood. And Lawrence Harvey, who was a witty Englishman, looked over and said, "What's wrong, Frank? Are we having our period today?" Sinatra broke into, to his credit, broke into laughter.
He could be kidded. There's a wonderful story in Will Friedball's book about, you know, 37 takes on a tune with Nelson Riddle, and Frank Sinatra says, "Let's do it again." And Harry Sweets Edison says, "Shit, baby, you can't do it no better than that." And they all laughed and went home. That was it.
Because it was time to go home, that's why.
Yeah, but I think that was the last take. Question about the movies, though, James. He made so many dogs, so many stupid Rat Pack movies. He never would have made those if they were songs. What was the difference?
The difference was that the movies for him, it was a very schizoid way of looking at his career. The movies for him initially were simply a vehicle for pushing forward his singing career, which preceded all things. His singing career trumped lovers, wives, friends, relations, everything, and it certainly trumped movies. He very quickly, when he went to Hollywood, got this reputation as one-take Charlie. That was all he would give a director. He was seen as an outsider in Hollywood. He was not taken seriously at all, especially through the MGM years, and then he was dropped from MGM. The Oscar for From Here to Eternity marked an incredible comeback, the greatest comeback of all time. And yet he did continue to make all kinds of movies. And they were, for him, they were moneymakers and they were billboards for his singing career.
Let's listen to a musical digression, but a tremendously interesting one. The big record he made with Antonio Carlos Jobim, those incredibly difficult Brazilian different songs, but some of these are sort of definitive now. Let's listen to Triste.
Your beauty is an aeroplane. so high my heart can't bear the strain. A heart that stops when you pass by, only to cause me pain. Sad is to live in solitude.
You know, they could, if they were playing that music as you entered heaven, it wouldn't sound amiss.
It wouldn't sound triste either.
No.
What is to say about reaching out to Jobim, a giant of his own scale?
Sinatra, of course, had huge respect for Jobim. He was a musical force beyond compare. And again, it was the class thing. It was he perceived in Jobim a poet, an absolute poet, a man of huge nobility, of quiet strength and dignity, and genius. And Sinatra wanted to work with geniuses every day of the week, if possible.
Speaking of geniuses, and he was not intimidated by any of them. He made one big record with Duke Ellington. It wasn't either of their favorites of all time, but it did have this wonderful Indian Summer on it with a very long solo. I think the longest instrumental solo ever recorded on a Sinatra album by Johnny Hodges.
You are here to watch over some heart that is broken by a word that somebody left unspoken. You're the ghost of a romance in June going astray, fading too soon. That's why I say
genius there, of course.
Yeah. And after the Hodges solo, supposedly, he said, John, how did you do that? And Hodges, as was his wont, said nothing. Speaking of giants, he recorded all sorts of things with Count Basie and the band he thought was the greatest musical aggregation in the history of the planet. And for me, these are some of the sort of definitive Sinatra sounds of all time. Let's listen to Sinatra with Basie and I Believe in You.
You have the cool, clear eyes of a seeker of wisdom and truth. Yet there's that upturned chin and the grin of impetuous youth. I believe in you. I believe in you. I hear the sound of
gorgeous,
good solid judgment whenever you talk.
You take it away on Basie, James.
Well, he's a fellow New Jerseyan. Let's start right there. Red Bank, New Jersey, Bill Basie. And he and Sinatra had enormous regard for each other, and just produced some, you know, that's joyous music.
My faith in my fellow man, oh, but falls apart. I've but to feel your hand grasping mine, and I take heart to see the cool, clear eyes of a seeker of wisdom and truth.
It is that is a band that is expressing sheer joy, and it is it's different from Billy May's brand of orchestral joy. It's a joy that is all Basie's own. It's an incomparable sound, and Sinatra knew it and loved it. And maybe it had something to do with those Jersey jeans.
I listened to those Ellington and Basie records all the time, and I think it's the classic hedgehog and the fox that Isaiah Berlin wrote about. The fox knows many things. That's Ellington. Many voices, many layers. The hedgehog knows one thing, and that is Basie, and that's 4/4 time. Who could teach Sinatra about 4/4 time more than Basie? And they did, but you feel an exchange there.
I will tell you a dirty little secret, and that is that on several of the cuts on those Basie albums, Bill Miller did sit in on the piano because as beautifully minimalistic as Basie was as a keyboard artist, there were some fill-ups that that only Miller could bring off.
It'll be volume 2 of your Sinatra pair that gets into what is to me the other most interesting thing about Sinatra, the man, the artist, the American, is his pulse of the zeitgeist. This is a man who called a tune, so to speak, for John F. Kennedy's election, left side of the Democratic Party in 1960, and 20 years later called a tune and worked the inaugural in the same fashion for Ronald Reagan of the new conservative right. Now that, I don't think, was simple opportunism. It wasn't just friendship. He loved JFK, certainly until J. Edgar Hoover said the president couldn't stay in Sinatra's house, called him Chicky Boy, and he knew Ronald Reagan well too, but he somehow mastered a change in the country. It boggles my mind. What would he be saying about our country today? But I mean, who understood America at some level deeper than Frank Sinatra?
He understood it, but he was also, Sinatra was ruled by his emotions. You know, he was deeply freaked out by the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 62. He, at that point in history, had a jet plane constantly on the ready in case he had to leave the country to flee nuclear attack. And he was deeply upset by the advent of rock and roll, by the political unrest and riots of the late 60s, the assassinations. He threw in with Hubert Humphrey in the 68 presidential election, but I think became right around then, not long afterwards, very disenchanted with liberal politics and the Democratic Party. I think a lot of it had to do with the rise of rock and roll and Vietnam, and there suddenly was Richard Nixon, and along came Spiro Agnew, who unfortunately became a good buddy and golfing partner of Sinatra's in Palm Springs. He just he was seeing the country change in ways that were deeply distasteful to him, culturally, politically, musically. He hated rock and roll, hated it with a passion. The legendary incident when Sinatra was riding around Los Angeles and Light My Fire came on for the third time in 20 minutes, and he kicked the car radio with the heel of his shoe. He just he didn't like what was going on, and things turned sharply left in this country in the late 60s and early 70s, and that was when Sinatra began to turn right. I don't think we should see him so much as a master of the zeitgeist as always hypersensitive, a reactor to the zeitgeist.
Would you call him unusually political for the sort of artist he was?
I would call him unusually thoughtful, well-read, and attentive to politics, to the American scene, and yes, the zeitgeist for an artist. So many musicians, you know, never crack open a book, don't care what's going on in the world. Sinatra, and this is why his story is such a huge one. It touches on so many aspects of American life in the 20th century. And let's not forget that he was an ardent admirer of FDR from the very beginning. And so politics were always his Dolly Sinatra was intensely political, and Frank in many ways became Dolly Sinatra. Right. He was intensely political, yes.
You speak about American roots. Your book has made me think of Sinatra as, in some strange way, an Emersonian individualist, a sort of extreme, two-fisted, my way kind of self-reliant American. But it's an old story, and he did it to a turn. I mean, I also think of Muhammad Ali and Ted Williams, the only other two people who have publicly that Sinatra confidence. Ted Williams at 19 saying, "All I want is when I walk down the street, people say, there goes the greatest hitter that ever lived." Sinatra could have said the same thought, I think. But it is a very American, wonderful ambition.
It is a wonderful American ambition, and I think an interesting riddle for us all to ponder on is where is that today? Is it Steve Jobs? Not exactly. Where is that today? What has become of that, and why? I'll leave that as a riddle.
Good, serious question. I want to leave us also with another of the innumerable Basie hits, but this was, and here's to you, Frank Sinatra. It's a good life.
It's the good life, full of fun, seems to be the ideal. Yes, the good life lets you hide all the sadness you feel. You won't really fall in love, 'cause you can't take the chance. So be honest with yourself, don't try to fake romance. It's the good life.
How should we remember him until you tell the rest of the story?
You know, I wanted to tell a story in this book, in the first book, that I don't think that people have paid much attention to before. And, you know, there are two huge groups of Sinatra fanatics, one whom I have great respect for. There are the completists, who can tell you what brand of clock was on the wall of Studio A, Capitol Records, on Melrose Avenue in 1959. And there are the nostalgics, who will tell you that there's no music like big band music, like swing music, or like Nelson Riddle. I have great respect for these people, but in my view, I see all great music as occupying an even playing field. And the striking thing about this story of Sinatra is, it is a story that feels fresh to me. It is a story of a great artist, great genius's beginnings. And despite the fact that we often see these pictures of him in black and white in the early years, I think of it all as being so vivid and new, and yet lesser known. And so I wanted people think of him in terms of the ring-a-ding-ding Sinatra of the late 50s and early 60s. I wanted to give another Sinatra and this genius in embryo and in formation that seemed so compelling to me.
James Kaplan, you say it beautifully. You've written it beautifully. I couldn't agree with you more about what Bono calls the now in Sinatra. Sinatra told him late at night out there in Palm Springs, jazz is about now and living in this moment. And he's still there. He's still with us.
Goodbye again. And if you find a love like mine, just now and then, drop a line to you say you're feeling fine. And when things go wrong, perhaps you'll see you're meant for me. So I'll be around when he's gone.
James Kaplan, thank you. Thank you for this book. Thank you for this conversation. Thank you for bringing Sinatra alive as if we needed it.
Thank you, Chris. It's a great honor to be here and a great pleasure to be able to speak so deeply about an artist I love so deeply.
Amen. Thank you, James Kaplan. Drop a
line to say that you're feeling fine. And when things go wrong, perhaps you'll see you're meant for me, so I'll be around when he's gone.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.